Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, the military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veterans Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now, here's Tom Lyons.
Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we take an in-depth look at the sacrifices made by our state's former prisoners of war. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
More than 70 years ago, in April of 1942, 64 Minnesota soldiers were subjected to unspeakable suffering during what is now known as the Bataan Death March. 75,000 Allied service members, imprisoned and weak by months of starvation and disease, were forced to undergo the five-day march. Japanese forces would kill those who were unable to continue, and thousands were mistreated and died. Of the 64 original Minnesota soldiers called up from the Brainerd and Park Rapids-based Company A, 194th Tank Battalion, only 32 survived to return home after the war. These heroic Minnesota Guardsmen endured some of the worst conditions imaginable during their captivity and showed the strength and resilience to survive. Today, I pay tribute to all the men who endured the Bataan Death March. Their sacrifice paved the way for today's Minnesota National Guard.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now is the Department Commander of the Minnesota American ex-POWs, David Claypool. David, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
And how is the Minnesota ex-POWs been going, and how's your membership doing?
Well, of course, we're losing some of our members, but we're changing our process, and we're keeping as many active members as we can, and so we're alive and well here in Minnesota.
Are you getting any of my Vietnam POW buddies to sign up?
Well, we have some that are members or have been members. However, they don't usually participate in the actual functions.
Well, it's about time those Vietnam POWs signed up and helped your organization.
Well, that would be wonderful if they did.
David, you brought a good friend and an interesting gentleman with you today. Can you tell us about him?
Yes, I can. I've gotten to know Dick very well. It's Dick Carroll, and he's been in this business since World War II of things like this military business as a POW. And he is the guy who has brought me forward into the organization as an officer. So he's the guy that keeps me involved, and I have him to help me. And between the two of us, we are usually successful.
Dick Carroll, you're now the Senior Vice Commander of the Department of Minnesota American ex-POWs, but you've been the commander several times. Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you.
Sir, did you recruit this gentleman, Mr. Claypool?
Absolutely.
Yes. And how's he doing?
He's doing quite well. You have to watch him very carefully, of course.
So you brung him, so you have to take care of him.
Yeah, that's right.
Sir, how many times have you served as department commander?
Five times. 5 years. In different intervals of time, yes.
And you're still active and working at it?
Yes.
All right, sir, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your military career. And you were born here in Minnesota, right?
That's correct, yes. Rosemount, Minnesota, on a dairy farm.
And World War II, changed your dairy farm, didn't it?
Yes, indeed it did. We suddenly found that Uncle Sam wanted our land. And they decided to take over 92 farms southeast of Rosemount, which included my father's farm and two older brothers' farms. Two were in dairy farming and one with beef cattle farming.
So they needed that property so they could manufacture some munitions, I would
think. That's correct, right. And with 30 days notice, that doesn't give you a lot of time to look for farms to move on to or to get moved and move all of your equipment and animals on the farm.
And kind of as a result of that, you ended up going into the service.
That's right. They changed my farming status to 1A, and I decided at that point I didn't want to be drafted. I'd rather enlist. So I enlisted as an aviation cadet for pilot training.
In the Army Air Corps?
in the Army Air Corps before Air Force.
Good to have another Air Force person in the studio again, though.
Thank you.
And where did you go to training?
We were sent to San Antonio, Texas, for the pre-flight part of our training. And it took 2 days to get there. We weren't exactly priority personnel on the railroad track. It took quite a while to get down to San Antonio.
Yeah, what month and year was that, sir?
That was in March of 1943.
So we'd been at war for a couple of years already.
Already, yes.
And we're marshaling forces and probably looking for pilots and co-pilots.
That's right. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, but Uncle wanted bomber pilots.
And once you sign, you raise your right hand and say yes, you have to do what you're told, don't you?
You do exactly as you're told.
So after you finished your training, then where were you sent?
Sent to combat crew training to orient ourselves to the B-24 aircraft and to work with the crew members to do our jobs so that we could be effective in combat.
We're speaking with David Claypool and Dick Carroll from the Minnesota Department of Minnesota American XPOWs on Minnesota Military Radio. Dick, once your training was complete, then when were you deployed and where were you sent?
We were sent with our brand new B-24 aircraft from Topeka, Kansas, over to the 15th Air Force, which at that time was located at Cerignola, Italy. It's 30 miles south of Foggia. That's the spur of the boot that sticks out into the Adriatic Sea, and that's where we flew our missions from.
Dick, how did you like the B-24, and how did you fly it all the way over there, or would you ferried it over there?
Oh, no. We flew it all the way through the southern route. We went down to South America and across the equator, and then back again, crossing the equator into Dakar, Africa, and then from there on up to Italy.
Sounds like a lot of hours on that trip.
Yes, yes. But that was good training, though.
Was it?
I flew across the equator. Usually you have storms and clouds for several hours, and we ended up, I logged 4 hours of instrument time because the cloud formations were completely on both sides of the equator, so that I was able to get in 4 hours of instrument time logged.
Good experience on the way to war.
Exactly.
How did you like the aircraft?
B-24 was a rather independent aircraft. You'd get it all balanced out so it was flying as it should, but without any warning, suddenly the nose would decide that it wanted to go to the left and downward, and if you weren't promptly on the controls to square it away, it could get you off, and it could be very embarrassing when you're flying formation.
So you had automatic pilot on that plane?
Negative.
No?
Never.
So when the plane has a mind of its own, you have to be on watch?
You have to pay attention, exactly.
So you took a long trip over to Italy, and where were you based there, and what type of missions were you flying?
We were based at Cerignola, just a mile out of town, and we were bombing targets from southern France, southern Germany, Austria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, including the Ploiești oil fields. I went there on 2 visits, dropping our bombs, the longest flak alleys in the world at that time. And then another tough target was Vienna, Austria, where they had 1,200 anti-aircraft weapons in place. And then Axis Ally would come on our frequency and tell us that we were bombing at Vienna that day. She was always 100% accurate as to where we were bombing, and she'd come on the air about 2 to 3 hours before the target, so that somehow the Germans had our operations down pretty well before we ever got to the target.
They knew you were coming.
Yes.
That's not good.
And then she'd tell us that they're bringing in another 200 anti-aircraft guns to help welcome us to the city.
Dick, how big a crew did you have on a B-24?
Normally, we had a crew of 10, but we normally functioned with only 9. We'd use a combination of bombardier and navigator so that we would only have 9 men on our crew.
And what kind of payload would you carry?
Pardon?
What kind of payload? How many bombs would you carry?
6,000 pounds. Normally, we carried 6 1,000-pounders, and quite often we would also use 12 500-pound bombs.
Now, Dick, at that point in the war, was the German fighter pilots weren't a big issue? It was more flak than anything?
More flak than fighter aircraft, except at Ploiești, Romania. That was a very important function to support the oil and gasoline for Army, Navy, and Air Force of the Germans. So they had their very best pilots defending the oil fields.
Dick, we have to take a short break. When we come back, as our listeners already know, you're a member of the Minnesota Department of Ex-POWs, so something happened in the war.
Something.
Yep. And we want to talk about that when we come right back. We're speaking to David Claypool, Commander of Department of Minnesota American Ex-POWs, and Dick Carroll, who's currently the Senior Vice Commander and has served as Commander many times on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking with David Claypool, the Commander, Department Commander of Minnesota American Ex-POWs, and his current Senior Vice Commander, Dick Carroll. And, of course, Dick was the Department Commander for 5 different times, I think. And, David, I feel like we're kind of ignoring you here today, but this is some fascinating stories that I need to get back to Dick, if that's right with you, sir.
Well, it's very precious time when you can talk to these guys for real, so go for it.
Dick, now we've learned that you grew up on a farm in Minnesota and you enlisted in the Army Air Corps. And you flew, you were a co-pilot on a B-24, and you flew it all the way over to Italy, and you're flying missions. You told me that your pilot picked you because he wanted a good farm boy as a co-pilot.
No, he didn't really pick me. He got me. I was assigned to that crew, yes.
But happy to have a good, strong Minnesota farm boy as a co-pilot.
That's right. That was important.
And you were flying. How many missions did you fly in Italy before July 2nd?
15.
15 missions, and then one day, July 2nd, 1944, the day you'll never forget.
Right.
Can you tell us what happened that day?
We had a change of address. We had to bail out of our disabled aircraft, and I had a good chute and landed. And I landed in a farm field. There were Canadian thistles nearby, which I thought, you know, it's amazing that Canadian thistles would be over in Hungary. I thought they belonged mostly in Canada.
Did you drop some of those out of your plane on a previous mission?
No. No, we dropped bombs. 500-pounders and 1,000-pounders. That was our specialty.
So on July 2nd, 1944, was it flak that got you think? And
yes, because we lost an engine that we had to try to feather, and it wouldn't feather.
Was this before or after your bombing run?
This was just before we were about to drop our bombs over Budapest, Hungary, where we're bombing a huge armament plant on an island just on the south edge of the city of Budapest. And we had to then pull away from the foundation and try to feather the engine that was damaged. So whether the flak got the engine or whether it just was an old engine that was running out of problems, and we had to try to feather the engine. We couldn't get it feathered. So if you keep flying with a plane with the engine running freewheeling, even though you've shut it down, it's turning over so fast that it eventually will break off the nacelle. And so you have no choice but to leave the aircraft.
So you parachuted out of the aircraft?
Yep.
And landed in Hungary?
Well, normally you would want to not open your parachute right away, because at 21,000 feet, there isn't a whole lot of oxygen and a lot of air to breathe. And it's rather cold up there, so it's better if you free fall for a while. And on top of that, of course, we're briefed by our briefers that occasionally German aircraft pilots would use our comrades that had parachuted out of their aircraft to actually use them as target practice. So it was better off to free fall part of the way down, because it'd be warmer, more oxygen, and less apt to be shot by a German fighter pilot.
So you made it and landed in a farmyard in Hungary?
In a farm, out in the farm in the middle of wheat fields and hay fields and pasture, yes.
And how did the people of Hungary treat you, Dick?
They didn't like us. The farm folks didn't have too much education. They were very much involved with propaganda by the German Army Department. And so consequently, the Hungarian farm people considered us to be Chicago gangsters, all from Chicago, Illinois. And our job was to fly 50 missions. They always had some truth in the propaganda. And that we would all go back to Chicago with $50,000 in our pockets and get a free... A pass, didn't have to spend any more time in jail.
We're speaking with Dick Carroll, a World War II POW, on Minnesota Military Radio. So, Dick, they thought you were a Chicago gangster, and you landed out on the farm, and here came the Hungarian peasants, and they didn't treat you very well, did they?
Not very well, no. They shot me. It was a Hungarian farmer. I never got to meet him. So there were many of the farmers that carried weapons. This happened to be a 7mm rifle that was used. And I knew immediately when I was shot, because the impact of the bullet. And then on top of that, it was I was literally on fire. And when the bullet is deep within your chest, there is nothing you can do about it. If you're shot in the hand or the arm, you can wave it in the air, you can stick it in some water to cool it down. But I was on fire deep within, and there was just nothing I could do about it. It was the best example I can think of just putting up with something that you could do nothing about.
And on top of that, the next peasant you met wasn't very nice either.
No, that's right. This farmer came up. He was about middle age, and he was only about 5'4", but he was pretty well muscled, and he had a long-armed, long-handled shovel that was as tall as he was. And he glared at me for a few minutes, or at least a while, and then walked around to my right behind me, and I knew what was coming, but I couldn't do anything about it, because in the meantime, two farmers came up and held me. I was starting to get sort of unbalanced, and so they held me by my elbows and held me erect, and at that time, when this farmer with the shovel got behind me, he hit me in the back of the head and knocked me very unconscious. You don't pass out immediately. You think that you would, but actually there's a tiny part of a second that you're aware of the noise of the impact, and it reminded me of Armin Killebrew back in the old days of being at Bloomington out in the outdoors, and you'd hear that solid smack of the ball, you knew that that was a home run that was going to leave the park. And that's the way that shovel sounded as it hit my back of my head, and I actually passed out. I could go through the stages of gray colors and dark gray, and then finally as it turned black, I was passed out, and at that time I felt my knees sort of turn to rubber, and I was unconscious.
And Dick, then you proceeded somewhere along the line, the army there or the home guard got a hold of you and you went to prison camp. But when you woke up, you found out that besides having a headache, you had a bullet lodged in your heart.
That's right. I didn't find that out until 5, 6 days or 7 days later because we were picked up by the home guard and they loaded us onto a truck and took us to a farming village, and they had a doctor come and check me. They had eight of our air crew on the back of this truck at that time, and I was laid on the parachutes. The doctor that came to the back of the truck and checked my heartbeat and so forth, and the first words that he said to me were, "Do you have any last wishes?" And I said, "No," and I didn't think that any delay in staying here at a small little village with a hometown doctor, I was hoping that they would get me to a bigger city where there'd be a hospital, because I was not in very good shape to stay alive.
But you made it.
But I made it.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with more from our American ex-POWs on Minnesota Military Radio in just a moment.
Hi, this is Bill Popp of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation. An Army squad is made up of 8 soldiers, and when the squad is on patrol, each soldier is dependent on each other for safety. When a soldier is distracted because of a financial crisis with the family back home, that puts every soldier on the squad at risk. The Minnesota Military Family Foundation helps turn a bad situation into a positive one. The foundation provides financial support during a financial crisis at home. This helps re-energize the soldier. The soldier feels the financial burden lifted and has feelings of pride because of the support from the community at home. When the soldier is no longer focused on the financial crisis at home, the soldier is able to stay engaged in the mission and do his duty to protect other soldiers in the squad. When we help one soldier, we're helping all soldiers. When we help one military family, we're helping all military families. If you're in a position to help, please donate. Go to MinnesotaMilitaryFamilyFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We'll get back to that interview with our Minnesota ex-POWs in just a moment. But now it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelliteau.
And interned as prisoners of war since the American Revolution. In their sacrifice to our country, former prisoners of war have sacrificed greatly to maintain the promise of liberty that we hold dear. This is why a grateful nation provides special benefits and care for our former prisoners of war and their families. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs provides information and assists former prisoners of war, ensuring they receive special consideration for VA health care and benefits, which was earned through their wartime incarceration. Let us vow to never forget the sacrifices of our former prisoners of war.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelliteau. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Now it's time to get back to our interview with our American ex-POWs.
I was not in very good shape to stay alive.
But you made it.
But I made it, and they took us to another little farming village. Farmers over there didn't live on farms. They lived on farming villages together. And they brought us into this military headquarters again. There were the farmers that were there on Sunday morning were standing there with their clubs and rifles, rakes and hoes, and some even 2x4 type pieces of lumber. that wanted to get at us, and the soldiers actually had to hold them away from us to get them into their military headquarters, where they put me on a cot in a little room. And the country doctor from there came in to examine me, and the first thing he said to me was, and he spoke English, of course, like the other doctor, which was unique because all others were only speaking Hungarian. And of course, it's real hard to converse with people that don't speak English and you don't speak their language. So communication is a big problem. But anyhow, this doctor had the same question of me, do you have any last wishes? Because he told me that my heartbeat was way up, almost out of control, almost to the point of having a fibrillation of the heart. And my temperature was 104.7. And it stayed there for 5 days until the end of the fifth day, and it finally broke to 102.3. At that point, the doctor told me at the Friday evening of that day that I was going to be moved to a hospital at Budapest. And I saw that was the best news that I had heard all week, that I was still there. And the next morning, they loaded me onto a train, and we went to Budapest, Hungary. And there, again, it was a big problem because the officer, the German officer, or rather the Hungarian officer at the railroad station had big problems with their telephone because of our bombing. He couldn't get people to answer his phone, so he would pound the phone on his desk to indicate that he wasn't very happy.
We're speaking with Dick Carroll, a World War II POW on Minnesota Military Radio. Dick, I know that I don't want to break the suspense here, but we know that you still have that bullet lodged near your heart.
That's right.
All these years later.
Yes.
It's
not only near the heart, it's actually within the heart. Although, as I mentioned, it was very hot and burning. So actually the heart muscle around the bullet was badly burned, and that eventually was sloughed off, and there's only the lining of the muscle, strand of muscle that holds it still there, because there's a absence of some of the muscle in the lower front of my heart. And of course, each beat of the heart, as it pushes the blood out into the body, the bottom of the heart moves up about an inch and a half. So every time my heart beats, this bullet is a well-traveled bullet because it moves up and down an inch and a half as each beat of the heart.
It's amazing how a body will react to foreign substances. And all these years later, you're still doing, you're still going great.
And here I am.
And here you are. Dick, you went through some POW camps, and the war eventually yes. ended, and you came home, and you got a job and worked
right.
a long career.
Yes.
Right. And you've been a member of the Minnesota American ex-POWs for a long, long time. But when you retired from your civilian career, it looks like you really went to work then to take care of your fellow POWs.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you've done since you retired?
Well, I didn't know that there was such an organization that had been in effect for quite a while, but they never, it was a well-kept secret in the St. Paul paper. We lived in St. Paul at the time. We didn't know that there was an organization called American Ex-Prisoners of War. So it wasn't until I was in the hospital at the VA at Minneapolis that one of the workers there made a point of contacting any POW that was hospitalized. And so he came to visit, told me about the organization, and that's when I joined. So that was in 1989.
Now, Dick, I understand that you had some issues with your service in the war, some nightmares, some a bad time, but you also had a high security clearance, and you needed that to keep your job until you retired.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So you really couldn't reach out and get any help with that until after you retired many years later.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. You didn't dare mention. Yeah. I had the top secret clearance plus the crypto clearance because we had crypto equipment at the 934th Military Airlift Wing at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. That's where I spent 21 years with the various Air Force organizations that were on the base there. And eventually it became a reserve base, and I was a civilian exec officer for 18 years.
At the 934th Reserve Campus out by the airport.
That's right.
So after you finally did retire, did the VA help you deal with some of the nightmares and the combat fatigue and some of those issues?
That's when they finally got to the point. I had post-traumatic stress syndrome 30 years before they discovered the disease.
They renamed it, though, didn't they?
They renamed it. We were combat...
combat fatigue and
fatigue,
now PTSD.
And now PTSD.
The deck,
30-some years of nightmares with always with German dogs that would chase me, and they would always get me down.
And then you'd wake up.
And then I would wake up screaming because they had got me down, and you cover your face and your throat, and you have left only your legs to kick. And so you kick, all the covers go flying off the bed. And your wife, of course, ends up being kicked in her legs. And my wife never, ever complained about that.
You wake up scared and wet, and it's a terrible nightmare.
Sweating. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Now, Dick, I understand that since you retired and you got help and you joined the ex-POWs, you've been able to help a lot of other POWs and the widows of POWs.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The help we got was from the psychologists and psychiatrists at the VA hospital. And their first, real quick, like, told us the best thing for us to do was to talk about our experience. So our organization then formed a speaking bureau with high schools and middle school students in and around the Twin Cities. And that's where I started telling my story. And it was helpful for me, obviously, because that after about a year and a half or so after I started speaking, that I started having less nightmares.
And Dick, it looks like all those speeches and helping the POWs and the widows has kept you pretty young.
Yes.
You look like you're in great shape.
And busy. For an old geezer, I'm doing okay.
David, I don't think I'd describe him that way, do you?
Oh, he talks about himself like that all the time, so I introduce him like that sometimes.
Do you feel like that he's your mentor and you're the protege, Dick, David?
He is absolutely my mentor, and he's my good friend, and it's a treasured relationship we have, and I appreciate him so very much.
It looks to me like you two have been a pretty darn good tag team for the Department of Minnesota ex-POWs for quite a few years.
We try.
Dick, any final thoughts for our listeners? It's quite a story. In July 2nd, 1944, what a day.
Yeah, no. I'm so fortunate to be alive, to be able to help others. It's done me very well. I'm very fortunate to be alive and to be so healthy as I am.
It's been a real pleasure to have you here today, sir.
Thank you.
David, any final thoughts for our listeners about the Minnesota's ex-POWs? This is quite a guest you brought with you today.
Well, it has several of those. I've gotten to know a lot of these guys. Dick has the exceptional story, but they make up the organization. They're it. I'm, as a next of kin, of course, not a prisoner of war, and I am very blessed, I guess, to say that I've gotten to know all these guys. And the organization does help itself. They exist to help those that need can't help themselves. And Dick's totally dedicated to that, and so that's what we do.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio. That was David Claypool, the Minnesota's department commander of the American XPOWs, and Dick Carroll, currently the senior vice commander, Department of Minnesota American XPOWs, on Minnesota Military Radio. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. Now let's get back to more of our interview with our American XPOWs. We've been speaking with David Claypool, commander of the Department of Minnesota of Minnesota American XPOWs, and Dick Carroll, currently the senior vice commander, Department of Minnesota XPOWs, American XPOWs, on Minnesota Military Radio. David, I want to talk to you about when the POWs come home, just like every other service member comes home, if they have issues, if they have problems, might lead to some kind of a claim. What kind of a process does an XPOW have to go through?
Well, of course, it's changed a lot since World War II. Here in Minnesota, we're pretty more effective than usual because we have people that help. But they have to go and apply for their benefits. And starting out years and years ago, of course, there were no presumptives. They had to prove a lot of things and do a lot of things to get into the system. And many of those guys didn't show up.
Well, let's talk about presumptives for a moment. We've had some folks on the show, and we've talked about Vietnam veterans, and there are some diseases that are presumed to have been caused by that theater of war and related to Agent Orange. So if you file a claim there, that was presumed, certain things were presumed to have been caused by that. So is there a special set of presumptives for POWs?
Yes, there are. There are 22 of those presumptives, and Dick is quite familiar and works with those.
Dick, and when you came back from the war and your civilian job, one of your jobs was to help process these type of claims, wasn't it?
That was the very first job I had as a civilian employee of the federal government.
So can you explain these special rules on the presumptives for POWs?
Primarily, they are diseases related to lack of proper food, and that causes different diseases. Those are automatically assumed with the POW experience, because no matter which theater of war we endured as POWs, we were short on nutritious food. That was a problem. As the war progressed, the food became more problems. For example, we had potatoes that were frozen that were issued to us as good food. And we had to learn whether it was a hard rot or a soft rot. The hard rot would cause dysentery. The soft rot would cause dysentery, and the hard rot we could eat, and as POWs didn't have any suffering from it.
So you learned that the hard way.
That's right. We learned to cut out the soft rot and eat the rest.
So that presumptive disease is due to long periods of time with inadequate groceries.
Correct. Right. Okay. And then it got into later on getting into other diseases, such as most all of the heart diseases, became service-connected automatically if a POW suffered a heart attack, for example.
Because of the physical stresses put on the body as a prisoner of war.
Right, yes, right? Yeah. So those were automatic, so that then it made it much easier to prove, because there were no hospital records of POWs unless you were actually in a hospital because of a loss of a limb or something. Then there might be some records that survived the war. But most prisoners of war had no experience of having any written records. So therefore, you filed a claim with the VA, it was always denied, even though you suffered years of being in prisoner of war status.
Until they passed this rule with the presumptives.
Which came much later, starting in the 1980s. And that's a long time after World War II.
So you had a big job to help the POWs, the ex-POWs, process these claims and convince the VA that their long periods of being imprisoned caused trouble.
Exactly. And most of them had, unless they had an arm or leg missing, didn't get a service connection, even though they suffered malnutrition for years. Yes.
Dick, did they pass a special rule for you and for people that had bullets in their heart?
No, that although it that was obvious that I didn't have a bullet in my heart when I went into service, and I came out of it, it was there. Therefore, they had to make that a service connected.
Well, I would hope they wouldn't argue that one too much,
right.
Dick.
Yeah.
So you spent many years helping POWs with these claims and service members.
And it was very discouraging work generally because POWs just didn't have any records to prove their problems, yes.
So when you joined the Minnesota American ex-POWs after you retired,
right,
you were still helping some of those folks with their claims process.
Even though I had been working for different federal agencies over those years because I went from one to another, just to show the point that the budget for veterans after World War II, after a year and a half after the war ended, the VA had less money in that current year than they did during the war years. Therefore, the VA had to go through reductions in force, and I ended up losing my job in the reduction in force, becoming an insurance clerk at the regional office at Fort Snelling. So even though I was no longer a contact representative helping veterans, I continued doing the work part-time as I had time to help POWs and their wives and widows.
And Dick, once the POWs, the ex-POWs, were approved and they had some type of disability and they were getting checks, as these POWs die, is there a special process for their wives they have to go through in order to retain those benefits?
Oh, absolutely. There is a provision for wives of service-connected diseases that entitles them to dependents indemnity compensation, which is a special award for widows of disabled veterans that have severe disabilities. And, of course, most of the POWs ended up with a large degree, anywhere from 50 to 100% disabled, that qualified their wives to be eligible for DIC. And so I did this as a service helping out, even though I wasn't working as a contact representative at that time.
So as a volunteer for years, you've been helping the widows process,
yes,
that paperwork, and still are.
And also helping getting additional compensation for disabled POWs that became involved with heart disease and so forth.
And Dick, I understand you know the process so well that you're able to get those applications processed pretty quickly.
Would you believe in many cases when I hand deliver the claim to the VA regional office at Fort Snelling, they have completed the process, and the following day they call me up and tell me that I can call the widow and tell her that she has a letter coming out day to today that informs her that she is qualified for dependents indemnity compensation and burial expenses partially paid.
So you're known on a first name basis out at the VA, I'm sure.
Sort of, kinda.
Do they sit up and say, "Sir, yes, sir"?
No. No. They know I'm an old geezer, but I'm helping out. Yes,
you're helping out some people that deserve some help,
and it makes the VA look that much better because it does help in the timely processing of claims.
Now, what does that do to the overall scheme of things on all of their claims? It takes so many days, and all of a sudden, here's Dick Carroll out there again, and you're getting them processed in a few days. It shortens the overall time period, doesn't it?
POWs are supposed to have a priority, and thank goodness at the VA regional office at Fort Snelling, it's a priority, yes.
Now, have you taught David how to do some of this, too?
No. He's He's too quick for me.
That's still, David, that's still on your to-do list as a protege.
Well, probably so, but, you know, I don't want to get in the middle of his job. He's I don't want to put him out of work.
It's keeping him young. You got to keep him out at the VA. Dick, once again, you're doing a fabulous job, and I think it's keeping you young. You look great. Keep it up for as long as you can.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today, and it's interesting to learn about this claims process for our ex-POWs. Joining me now from the flag line of the Minnesota Patriot Guard is Tim Leinhart. Tim, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Tim, how's all our riders doing in Minnesota these days?
They're doing awesome.
Going to missions and showing up.
Holding flag lines and treating our veterans and our families with honor, dignity, and respect.
That's what we've come to learn. It's a great thing, Tim. You and your riders are doing a great job.
Yes, it's an honor.
I know you wanted to talk about one particular mission.
I do. We had a mission. It was a MIA mission. It was up in Dayton, Minnesota. And I'm just going to use his first name, but Harry had been missing for 66 years. He was shot down over an island in the Pacific. And what touched me so much is the family had remembered him for 66 years. His immediate family celebrated until they were all gone, and then the nieces and nephews took over, and every year they celebrated Harry being missing. And when he came home, I had the honor of running the mission along with Joe Egan, which is here with me today, and I was so impressed with everything they had done for everything. I mean, they even had T-shirts. They had a memorial set up with movies and pictures of Harry and everything else. And every year they came back to Dayton, and they just celebrated his life until he came home. And then they were all there. The whole family from all over the country came up there just so that they could welcome Harry home.
So you and your riders got a chance to meet Harry too and find out who he was.
We did. You know, it was just really awesome. We had about 150, 160 Patriot Guard there, and we lined the streets, and they didn't even have a hearse to carry him to the cemetery. The honor guard carried him all the way from the church all the way to the cemetery. It was about two blocks. Walked down the middle of the street. We lined the streets, and family followed the casket, and then our members folded in right behind them. It was a beautiful sight.
So after 66 years, it brought a little closure to that family.
It really was, and they were excited that he was there. It wasn't like it was just something they had to do. They were waiting for Harry to come home.
Joe, that sounds like it was a special mission.
It was, including the flyover. They came in at tree level and came directly over that, and one just went straight up and shook the earth, and it was a riveting experience, as well as a surprise.
Sounds just beautiful. Mm-hmm. Joe, who's eligible to become a Patriot Guard rider?
Well, it's easy and it's open. You do not have to be a veteran. You make a commitment, first of all, for honor, dignity, and respect for the fallen heroes. Go to the website, keyword search, MinnesotaPatriotGuard.org. Follow the instructions. You put in your zip code, and you'll automatically be assigned into a sector, one of 20 throughout the state. And the communication is all by email. Go get a 3-foot by 5-foot flag, come with respect, and do the flag line, and you will be exposed to a personal experience of compassion and empathy that maybe you've never realized ever in your life, and you'll meet some of the greatest people on the earth.
And, Tim, it's not just a bunch of old Vietnam veterans on their motorcycles, is it?
It's not. We have people that come in cages, which is a vehicle of some sort, usually four
like
wheels.
Me.
people like you, Tom. But yeah, no, it's you don't need a motorcycle. All we need you is just some way of getting there. We don't care if you're like, I think you mentioned one time about coming in on parachute, but that might be a little hard to make it.
Somebody will show up by parachute one of these days, Tim. It's all about having a good heart and, as you say, showing honor, dignity,
and respect.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining us again today. From the flag line of the Minnesota Patriot Guard, that was Tim Leinhart and Joe Egan. We're just about out of time. If you have a mailbag question or a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to address, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com and click on Contact Us to send us a note. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. like to thank our guests for joining us this week from our American ex-POWs, David Claypool and Dick Carroll. Commissioner Larry Shalitow, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to Minnesota Military Radio with Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition firm. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Podcasts of the show are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.